from HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 283, recorded live Monday, September 5th, 2011. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Paul Stovell about launching his own ISV.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I thought of it last week. We did it last week, Startup Series. This is Startup Series number 2, and I'm talking with Paul Stovell, recently moved from Australia to London. How are you, sir?
I'm good, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me.
You did it. You started your own company.
That's right. Technically, I've started a company. We're not really trading at the moment, but yeah. There's a product, and hopefully it'll go on sale very soon.
So is it a big deal to start a company anymore? I mean, I know I did a show with Secret Geek a while back on a micro ISV. It seems like that's the hip new thing to do. You start a tiny, tiny company, and you have no support department. It's just all in the cloud.
That's right. Yeah, it's been surprisingly easy so far. I guess I'm probably ignorant of how complicated it actually is, and so I'm just kind of doing one step at a time. And so far, it's actually been quite easy. A lot of the things in Australia, at least, you can register online to get set up, and very similar in the UK where I am now.
So you're an Australian citizen, but you're in London working. Did you give any thought to that, or are you just doing all of this as an Australian?
So actually, I'm contracting here in the UK for an investment bank and using that same business to develop a product. So it's a UK-based company.
Okay. So how do you start this? You mean you come up with a name for your company, and then what? What's involved?
I guess you come up with a name, you check that it's available. In this case, it's based on my last name, so it wasn't too hard to find something. And then you register it online, and there's a lot of service providers that'll do that. At that point, you've got a company. For contracting, there are a few extra things to do, like around insurance, etc. But generally, I think it took maybe a couple of days to get the whole thing legally set up as an entity. Some things like setting up bank accounts are, in the UK at least, a lot more difficult. But that's really all there is to it.
So definitely something that you should do as an entity. You should make this like an LLC or a corporation. And it doesn't sound like the kind of thing you'd want to attach your name to and just say, hey, I've got a PayPal, start sending me cash.
Yeah, well, Bob Walsh has a good book, Micro ISV, From Vision to Reality. And he kind of talks about the different company structures that are available, a company, sole trader, that kind of thing. But there seems to be a lot of tax advantages to doing it through a company, and I guess I needed a company to contract through, so it kind of kills two birds with one stone.
Mm-hmm. So what was your checklist of things you needed to do once you got your paperwork and your checks and you made your name? There's the usual stuff that I think folks who are listening to the show obviously know how to do, register domains and set up things, but there's a lot of stuff like discussion boards and hosting and who does your email and where your source code and your tracking and continuous integration, all these things. How did you make those decisions, and what did you end up going with?
Yeah, I'd like to say it was a long and well thought out process. It's kind of just been making it up as I go along. I started with, you did an interview with Leon Bambrick from Australia.
Secret Geek.
Yeah, that's right. About his micro ISV, and he had a list of about 25 things. So I kind of started from there. So getting domains, they're some of the obvious things. My email is hosted through Google Apps. Mm-hmm. Discussion boards are through Tender. And a lot of this is actually just looking at products that I admire, like Agile Zen and App Harbor, and seeing, I guess, how they're doing things and the way they interact with their customers. And it turns out those are quite good services.
So is that the way you thought of it? You said, let me look at some of the smaller companies that I respect and see what they're using for their discussion boards or what they're using for their hosting?
Yeah, that's right. I figure if I like the company and other people do, then they must be doing something right. And I guess at this stage, it's you kind of want to just focus on building a product. So if you can offload a lot of the things like running discussion boards and email hosting and all of those things, then that's a really good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So email hosting and stuff like that is obvious. It's either Google Apps or Office 365. It's all in the cloud. There's no person to manage the Exchange server. It's Google Apps. It's out there and it's handled. That's a no-brainer. But things like source code hosting, you could have done many different things. You could have done, you know, private Bitbucket repository, but you went with one called Kiln. I think that's Joel Spolsky's company.
Yeah, that's right. I initially started with Bitbucket, but with Bitbucket, because of the focus on social coding, which is really nice, you mm-hmm. tend to have, you know, it's Paul Stovell slash a project. Mm-hmm. And I guess for something that I'm hoping is going to be a long-term business, I want it to be more about, I guess, the company or the product first. So using Kiln, I guess, was nicer for that. And it's free, I believe, for one user. So that works perfect for me.
And is there any integration with issue tracking or bugs in Kiln? Because I know that if it's Joel Spolsky, then it's probably got something with Fog Bugs or one of his bug tracking softwares.
Yeah, when you get a Kiln account, you also get a Fog Bugs account. I don't actually use it. I'm using AgileZen from Nate and Nikki Kahari. Mm-hmm. I guess for me, I have a very short list of features I'd like to add, and I don't need a whole lot of detail about them. And I use the discussion boards for, I guess, any kind of bug reports. So AgileZen's, I guess, a bit simpler, and I don't really miss having any integration. I think it's sometimes a bit overrated.
So when you get these different tools working together, I mean, task tracking is AgileZen, source code with Kiln. I assume you have continuous integration.
Yeah, so I guess in the days of the cloud, I'm perhaps going a bit backwards. So I ended up just paying to put a dedicated server in a data center. Oh. And I'm running my own virtual cloud, I guess, on top of that. And so part of that is a CI server using TeamCity.
Hmm. And why did you choose to do that when there's so many hosted choices? I mean, is there something that we should know as listeners who are trying to learn from you? Or is this just you're not bought into the cloud yet?
I guess the two main advantages of cloud that you see discussed a lot, the first is this kind of commoditization of hardware. So there's supposed to be a lot of cost savings. And the other part is just the on-demand scale out. It's a lot easier to add lots of servers. Mm-hmm. Being able to add a lot of servers for me for kind of private infrastructure stuff, I guess, isn't that important, but costs are at this point. So when you sit down and do the math to get, for example, on Azure to get three machines that you can remote desktop into and do stuff with, mm-hmm. You're probably looking at about, in Australian dollars, it's about, say, $90 per machine, maybe about 50 British pounds. Whereas to get a dedicated server with, say, 32 gigs of RAM, at least here in Europe, is quite cheap. And so for me, it worked out easy just to rent a server and then put my own virtual hosting on top of that.
Interesting. So are you running like Hyper-V on that and then you have virtual servers? Because one of the things that I think that I would do if I were going to start my own company is I would make sure that I had snapshots and the ability to undo things, and using either Hyper-V or some kind of virtualization service would be what I would want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm using VMware ESXi, mm-hmm. which is just a bare metal hypervisor. And then on top of that, there are about 8 different virtual machines.
Interesting. And you can remote into the hypervisor part of things and tell it what to do?
Yeah, there's kind of a remote administration console that you use to set up virtual machines, take snapshots, all of those things. And then I can remote desktop into all of the machines on top of that.
Interesting. Had you looked at any of the virtualization as a service type services? Like, I know that there's VastNet, VaaSNet, which is literally all they do is virtualization as a service, and then you just rent by the hour a virtual machine?
Interesting. No, I hadn't looked at that. I guess the main providers I looked at were Amazon EC2, Azure, and in Australia there's a company called Ninefold, who are also a cloud provider. Mm-hmm. But just doing the math for the costs of some of those, it just turned out a bit cheaper to get a server.
So this is interesting, though. You admit to happily doing the math. You actually did this, because I'm not very good at that myself, and I tend to just go with my gut. But it sounds like you actually did some analysis here and thought about what the bottom line was going to be.
Yeah, if you look at, say, the Amazon EC2 pricing pages, to get a virtual machine with, I'm not sure if it's 512 or 712 meg, and they'll kind of give you hourly pricing. But when you imagine that there's about, if you want your servers running all the time, there's about 720 hours in a month, mm-hmm. it pretty quickly adds up, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I guess you're right. The idea with Azure or one of these kind of things that's in the cloud, if they're going to start charging you $100 a month, it doesn't take more than a year before you buy a machine. with the money that you'd be spending in the cloud.
Yeah, exactly. The benefit of it, of course, is that if you did need to suddenly add five extra servers to cope with demand, to do that with a dedicated server, I'd probably be looking at, you know, a couple of weeks to provision that. So I do see using the cloud as a way to, if I need to kind of rapidly scale something up, and that would be a nice problem to have, you know, then I would look at the cloud. But I guess for the long term, it just seems a bit cheaper this way.
Okay, so talk to me about the business and what you're selling, and then we'll get back to the cloud, because I think that the cloud has a place to play within your business. So what's your product?
So the product is Octopus, and it's an automated deployment solution for corporate environments. So I think of it as a bit like a TeamCity meets AppHarbor meets NuGet, but within your enterprise.
Okay, so it's a deployment system, so that I have my source code already. I assume that I'm using something, whether it be TFS or HG or Subversion. I'm a company. Mm-hmm. And let's say that I'm agile and I've got Kanban boards and I think I'm really awesome, except once a week, some guy opens up two windows in Explorer and then drags a folder from one machine to another. And that's our deployment.
Yep.
Right. That's Fred. Right. Fred is our deployment system.
That's right.
Is that where you come in?
Yeah. So Octopus, I guess, takes over Fred's job or makes Fred's job a bit easier.
Or Fred is let go because he was opening two Explorer windows.
That's right. So you would check code into your source control system, have your build server, so Team Build or Team City, take that code and package it up into a NuGet file. Mm-hmm. And then the job of Octopus is to take that NuGet package and figure out how to get it onto all of the machines you plan to deploy to. And Octopus has this very strong understanding of test environments, staging environments, and production environments.
Interesting. So there's two interesting things there that I just caught. First, the build server makes a NuGet file. So you're using a NuGet file, which is just a zip file with a manifest. You're using NuGet as the unit, the package. That is the build artifact.
That's right, yeah. So if you think about automated deployment, there's kind of four parts to it. So there's what do you want to deploy? So that's the package or the artifact. There's how do you get it to that machine that you actually want to put it on? There's the configuration of it, and there's the installation. And, you know, back when Linux took over the world and we used to, you know, you'd run one command to download a package, the next one to unzip it, the next one to make it, the next one to install it. It's really those same four things in any automated deployment solution. So NuGet works really well as a packaging format for doing that.
Now, why? You know, I know that NuGet's, you know, the hot thing that people are talking about, and I'm certainly trying my best to make people talk about it. But ultimately, though, it is just a zip file with some additional metadata. Why NuGet? Are you trying to shove in, you know, context and meta information into a format that doesn't necessarily wasn't designed for that?
Yeah, so there's two reasons for using NuGet. One is a technical reason. Really, I guess if we think about what some of the alternatives would be, you've got things like MSIs, MS deploy packages, mm-hmm. or just creating your own zip files. The benefit of NuGet is that manifest has a lot of really rich information about versioning. Because when you're deploying, especially if you look back over the history of what you've deployed, it's really important to know exactly what version of your software was deployed at what point in time. And that's something you definitely don't get when Fred has his two Explorer windows open.
Yeah, exactly.
So that manifest information is really rich. The other part, the technical part of NuGet, is the OData feeds. So it makes it very easy for something like Octopus to query and find out what versions of your software are available, and then to deploy those, which if you're just using, say, MSIs or web deploy packages, you'd have to have some way of kind of querying them and gathering them together.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, Team Pulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, Facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. I have experience in doing automated distributed deployments. I used to work at a bank, and we developed a system that used PowerShell. And this was kind of before MS Deploy was really like mature enough to use, and it was not really well understood. And we basically, what we did is we had the build artifact pop out of the build server. We then checked the build artifact into another subversion. We had a subversion source control system that represented what an idealized system would look like. We checked it in and we labeled it. So that was our versioning metadata. We would label it. Then we would send information to a service that was running on one of many, many boxes. There might be 20 boxes, and they all had this service. And that service would then go and do a get from subversion at that label and then bring the stuff down. So it would kind of fan out, and then everyone would do a big get, and they would basically check out from source control this folder. But then the issue of like COM objects and registration and permissions and ACLs and all the kind of stuff came along. How does your solution solve those kind of hairier problems? I mean, getting the files from, you know, point A to point B is only step zero.
Yeah. So I guess Octopus works in a fairly similar way. So the metadata and the versioning comes just from having the NuGet packages. Mm-hmm. Octopus picks those up and pushes it out to agents that run on all of the machines that you're planning to deploy to. Mm-hmm. It's more of a push-based deployment model because one of the scenarios I wanted to enable with Octopus was not just deploying to machines that are on your corporate Active Directory domain, but if you have, say, a data center in another part of the city, at the moment we often do that just using FTP or finding some other way of getting the files onto there. So we want to be able to kind of extend it, perhaps even out onto the cloud. So that's the kind of getting files there. Dealing with things like ACLs, component registrations, a lot of that is still done using PowerShell. The thing that Octopus saves you from is figuring out how to run the PowerShell scripts remotely. So I don't know if you've ever, you probably configured PowerShell remoting through WinRM. It's maybe I'm just not smart enough, but I found it very, very difficult.
Yeah, it's known to be a little bit baroque. In my case, we had to do this before PowerShell remoting existed. So I ended up making a PowerShell remoting service of my own, hosting the PowerShell run space, and then doing that work that way. Are you sending the NuGet files over to the deployment tentacles, the nodes at the end, the other side, and then having the PowerShell run there?
Yeah, so the agents are called tentacles, and that's kind of where the Octopus comes in. The Octopus controls the tentacles. Mm-hmm. So Octopus will go to NuGet and get the package, and then it will work out which tentacles need that package, and it'll push them out through a WCF call. And that call is secured through a couple of X509 certificates, so there's kind of a pretty strong security aspect to this. So that package gets uploaded to the tentacle, and then the tentacle runs the installation locally. So it will unzip the package, it'll replace web config values. There's a whole bunch of conventions that get run, calling PowerShell scripts, configuring IIS websites, mm-hmm. and that's kind of the deployment done. So it's pretty much the same service, yeah.
Interesting. Now, I'm comparing this with the one thing I know, which is the system that I built a long time ago, but I'm not in any way trying to imply that my 7-year-old or 8-year-old, you know, system of MacGyver rubber bands and paper clips is comparable to an actual product, but I'm just going to use it as an example. Because we were using source control, we could tell if someone had modified something on a machine. We had a number of situations in large banks where, you know, machine number 17 of 20 is acting weird, and we could actually go into Explorer on that machine and look and see, oh, well, that's changed because someone's modified this. I can compare it to the source up in the sky. Is that the responsibility, you think, of a deployment system to know that one of the machines is no longer in line and then get them back into line? And can you do that?
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of a social problem in the sense that you kind of hope that your ops people won't do that. But realistically, I don't think there's a large company in the world that doesn't have a copy of web.config somewhere.
Mm, exactly.
But so there is one aspect of that. When the package is uploaded, because NuGet packages, they have like a signature, so we can tell that it hasn't been modified before it got installed. But after it's installed, it would be a really nice feature in Octopus to be able to say, well, you know, when we installed everything, here's the files that were there and what they hashed to it, and have they changed? And that's hopefully something that'll come in version 2.
Okay, so you're doing just like NuGet does when you're dealing with this at a project level. You're keeping that NuGet zip file around so that you have a comparison. You have kind of an internal version control. You can tell that the one I deployed is the one that's still on disk.
That's right, yeah.
That's clever. Do you think this is going to confuse people? Because I've spent a lot of time trying to explain that NuGet's not for installing software, but it sounds like the people have spoken and they are going to be installing software with NuGet.
Yeah, I guess. So the other reason for choosing NuGet is that it's a format that's familiar to developers. So if you compare it to MSIs, for example, I know a lot of people that use Wix. I've never met anyone that enjoys using Wix and for creating MSIs. And that's not really a reflection of Wix. I think Wix does the best job it can, but MSIs are just very complicated. Whereas NuGet packages, developers are becoming intimately familiar with them. You know, every time I love it actually. When I create a new project, you know, I do file a new project, I right click and I say add library package reference. And then I kind of go on this shopping spree of, you know, what packages are available that I could use that would be, mm-hmm. you know, fun and interesting. So developers, I think, they're really liking NuGet, and it is a very simple file format and it's very convention-based. And I think that works very well for deployment as well.
So why don't you walk me through how that would work? Let's say that for example, we just updated Nerd Dinner to version 3. We put in Razor and all this kind of fancy stuff. And I've got a VM that's up in the cloud somewhere. Right now, I right-click and I say publish, but I do it from Visual Studio. I could probably type MS deploy from the command line. We have continuous integration at TeamCity. We have a cloud-based continuous integration server that TeamCity's been kind enough to let us use at CodeBetter. How would I change my deployment, and what would something like Octopus add to that experience?
So you would check in the changes that you've made. TeamCity would build that source code, run the tests, those things. Out of that, you would get a NuGet package that says this is version 1.5 of NerdDinner.
Okay, but I don't do that now. I don't make a NuGet package as a build artifact right now. I just have a bin folder.
Yeah, so you would need to create the NuGet package. That's actually fairly easy because if you have the NuGet command line, NuGet.exe, mm-hmm. right. It's fairly easy just to take a folder and turn that into a package. One of the things I'd like to be able to do is just, because TeamCity does provide sort of RSS feeds about the artifacts that it has, to be able to kind of implicitly create a NuGet package for you straight out of TeamCity.
Yeah, I think they announce, I mean, I've been working with them about NuGet support, and I know that they support pulling NuGet packages in. Do they support making them now in their new version?
Not that I've seen, although I know you did a blog post about this a little while ago. I wasn't sure if it was for publishing NuGet packages or creating them.
Well, they'll bring NuGet packages down. They'll restore them from a packages.config if you don't already have them there. We'll have to check. I'm sure that we'll find out as seconds that this podcast is over that they either do or they don't. But it sounds like they're bought in on NuGet. TeamCity is bought in on NuGet. So it sounds like having a build artifact where I could just flip a switch and say, oh, by the way, after this is built, make me a NuGet package out of it would be easy. But it sounds like it's just a batch file, NuGet pack foo.csproj or nerddinner.csproj.
Yeah, that's right. So you're in my case, my TeamCity configuration, it runs an MS build file. And the last mm-hmm. line of that is just a call to execute nuget.exe. Here's the folder, here's the manifest, and out pops a package.
Okay, so the package pops out. But let's say for my NerdDinner application, I need write access to the logs folder. So it's not just a straight website. I need a special write access for my whatever my user that I'm running as. And that's a curveball that I'm throwing at you. What do I do then?
Yeah, so in that case, if you imagine building a NuGet package for, let's say, a third-party component that you were producing that you wanted to use from me within Visual Studio, the way you would do those kind of custom one-off things in NuGet is you would create an install.ps1 file. So in Octopus, it works on a very similar convention. So the script that grants those permissions, you would create a PowerShell script, you would call that deploy.ps1, and you would just put that somewhere inside your NuGet package. And when Octopus unzips it, it'll inspect the package, and if it finds that file, it'll run it as the local system.
Okay, so with NuGet today, we have init.ps1, install, and uninstall.ps1, and these are conventions that are specific to when a library is used in a project. So you're inventing your own convention, so deploy.ps1 is what would happen when the deployment occurs. And at that point, I could call cackles from the command line and set the echo however I like.
Absolutely, yep. And the thing that it saves you from doing is figuring out how to run that script remotely because it's being run on the local machine.
Okay. What about IIS things, making sites and the kind of usual IIS stuff that I want to do? A lot of that can be in the web.config now in the system.web server area, but still, I might want to do something to IIS or register a COM object.
Yeah, I'd really love some way of, because IIS configuration is very complicated, and I would love some way of, by convention, figuring out that, you know, that's a .NET 4 project and you want it in this virtual directory, all of those kind of strange things. At the moment, the way it works is you would, when you first set up that server, you would remote desktop in as you do to set up all the other things. You would install IIS and you would create a website with a name that matches the name of your package. So you might have an IIS website called NerdDinner or nerddinner.web.
Right.
When Octopus unpacks your package, it'll find a web.config file and it'll make this assumption that, well, because that's a web config, this must be a website. So can I find a website in IIS that has the same name? And if I can, I'll update the home directory to point to where I've just unzipped this package. So you kind of do the one-off IIS configuration at the start, but Octopus will, I guess, continue to update that configuration as you deploy new versions.
I see. So this is kind of the convention over configuration that we're seeing so much of lately. We heard about it first in Ruby on Rails a number of years ago, and now the idea of letting the software do the right thing based on convention is we're seeing it everywhere now.
Yeah, that's right. I think my past experiences with automated deployment is there tends to be a lot of scripting involved, and they tend to be very very ad hoc, and every project is different. So I might have two different teams in my company, both working on ASP.NET solutions. They're both using jQuery. They're both using Razor. There's a lot of those things that they would just do because it's the easy way to go, you know, that whole pit of success thing. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to deployment automation, there's no kind of obvious solution. So one of them might involve a document that someone has to read to manually deploy. The other might have a whole set of scripts. But using these conventions, it kind of just saves you from having to reinvent that wheel all the time. If so, another convention in Octopus, for example, is, and this is inspired from App Harbor, imagine that you're deploying to some code to your test environment and then to a production environment. So the website that you're deploying probably has a SQL Server database behind it. And so in your config file, you would have a connection string setting pointing to the database that you want. So with Octopus, because Octopus comes with this web console for setting up your deployments, you can define a variable and say, well, the connection string for staging is this value, and the connection string for production is this value. And Octopus, when it unzips your package, it'll look in your web config, and if it finds a connection string that matches a variable that you've defined, it'll just replace the value for you, so you don't have to write all those XPath replacement expressions.
I see. So you're making the deployment environment aware. I had this conversation with a guy internally at Microsoft recently, you know, about web config transforms. Like there's you can have web.debug.config and web.release.config, and those things run at publish time. But those are build variables like build and release, debug and release rather, that are showing up in the names rather than things like dev, staging, and test.
Yep.
So you're kind of making environment a first class citizen.
Absolutely. So Octopus also does web config transforms. If there's a config transform called web.release or app.release, so this will work with Windows services as well, it will run that. It'll also run if your environment is called staging and production, if it finds a web.staging.config and it happens to be deploying into staging, it'll run that file as well. Mm. But generally, you'd run the web config transforms as part of building the package, and you'd just be replacing some configuration values as part of your deployment. But Octopus definitely has this understanding of environments and machines. So a lot of deployment tools kind of focus on how do I deploy one package to one machine.
Right.
Octopus is all about how do I deploy potentially multiple packages in a certain order to a lot of different machines.
The underlying question underneath my question was that I've already got an investment in a web dot, you know, debug.config. I've done my work in the XML deployment transformation language, the kind of metadata language that I've, you know, I don't want to go and write XSLT, or I don't want to go and use your, you know, the Octopus token replacement system. It sounds like you're not going to necessarily take away the things that I like about something like MS Deploy and force me to use your thing. I can pick and choose.
That's right. Yeah, I actually would really like to embrace a lot of the defaults. So, you know, if I'm working on a project and I inherit an ASP.NET solution, I would expect that any settings are going to be in the app settings section, and I would expect that connection strings are in connection strings. And so Octopus has no client libraries. There's no special things that you have to do to make Octopus happy. Hopefully, it's just following the default conventions that work with .NET.
When I'm just curious of a couple of things, and I'm just asking because I have intimate knowledge of these other products, not because I necessarily have an opinion one way or the other. I'm still thinking about it. But, you know, there are things that you can already do today and have been able to do in IIS, like create a package. Web Platform Installer uses this. I can set up something in IIS. I can set up a website. I can right-click on it, and I can say export as application, and I'll get a zip file that has a manifest and it has parameters.xml that already exist. And it's a very, very rich, albeit slightly complicated, you know, way to do things. And then I can go and import that package or deploy it with MS Deploy. Why not embrace that IIS specific, very rich metadata, then invent a new thing in NuGet?
So, I do actually have plans, hopefully just after version one of Octopus comes out, to also be able to work with those packages. So you would produce using the publish option in Visual Studio, or through calling MS Deploy as part of your build, you might produce an MS Deploy package and then just quickly wrap it up in a NuGet package to get all that rich versioning metadata. And then Octopus, because if you've ever, you know, when you try and invoke that MS Deploy command line to pass in the parameters, it's a little bit, you got to spend a bit of time kind of reading the documentation to get that right.
I think you're being extra nice. Yeah, it's a crazy command line. It's one of those command lines. It's like writing a regular expression, but once you get it to work, just don't move because it works.
Exactly, exactly. So Octopus will hopefully at least take care of invoking MS Deploy over your deployment package. So if you do need to do some really crazy things with IIS, that's one option. The other option is just using PowerShell. You can use the Microsoft Web Automation APIs, and you can just kind of pull those into PowerShell and then, you know, make changes to websites, set up app domains, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So things like the Web Farm framework. I mean, I know I might sound like a Microsoft shill in the sense of I'm kind of pimping our other features, but this is all free stuff that already exists. I'm not trying to like push people towards it, as I am trying to let people know that the things already exist. I think IIS and the IIS modules and the things around IIS are, I've said this before publicly, are ridiculously powerful and just poorly documented. You know, and I hope that future versions aren't, but the IIS tools by far are some of the most powerful tools in the entire web stack, and they're some of the least well documented, like the WebForm framework and MS Deploy itself. I mean, it's crazy if you can get it working, but if you can't get it working, you just give up.
Yeah, that's right. I guess the other area where that lets you down is it's not all. Often when you're building a website, you're not just building a website. There's also perhaps a set of Windows services that you need to be able to run in the background. Mm-hmm. There's changes to a database that you need to make, all of those things. So using a very simple packaging format like NuGet, I think it makes it a little bit more consistent, because the way you're deploying a Windows service is the same way that you're deploying a website, you know, if you can kind of follow some of these conventions.
Very cool. And then just kind of in closing, how do you plan on selling this?
So I guess my goal is to be able to walk into less businesses that have copy of WebConfig. So I'd really like to just see people doing more automated deployment. And so Octopus is free for the first project. So you can deploy to as many machines as you like, as many environments as you like, for one project, which might be a website, services, database, all of those things. Hopefully by the time you're around to doing a second project, you'll be willing to pay for it. At that point, it'll be around about £700. which may seem like a lot, but when you think about how much time you'd actually spend just writing PowerShell scripts and configuring WinRM, it's probably a few days worth of work. So hopefully the time savings will make up for it.
Well, like you said, if it's free for one project, so I could download this now and try to get this working with NerdDinner, no problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Very cool. And this is at octopusdeploy.com, and I guess while it's in beta, it'll be free.
That's right. Yep, yep. So free for unlimited projects while it's in beta. Hopefully, I'll be putting in the payment system soon, and I'll try and offer some kind of discount for if you purchase it during the beta period, and then it'll still continue to be free for one project after that.
Very cool. And I one thing I would also say is I've always enjoyed your blog and the knowledge that you have. I hope that you blog more. I think good blogs come out of creating good software, and it would be nice to see some of the lessons learned as you're you know, solving problems and coming up with things. You know, even if you are doing this as a commercial venture and not open sourcing things of it, you can still, you know, really pass the knowledge along about some of the stuff that you're doing. It'll be really interesting to see kind of the diary of building Octopus Deploy.
Yeah, yeah, it's something I'd love to do. I guess it's always that trade-off between do you spend a night writing a blog post, because it takes me a while to write a post, or do you spend a night just kind of building the features and kind of put it off? And I guess trying to find a bit of balance there is a bit difficult.
Well, I think get the work done first, but we'll all look forward to hearing about how it happened.
Great, great.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today, Paul Stavell. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I hear the fade-out music.
Is the music starting? This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.